We came up on Saturday morning, and the brokers who had a position that they didn't want to either pay for the stock and take it out or to deliver it could wrote on a slip that they wanted to carry it over. And provided that one could very often match this up between different brokers, and one charged a rate. So the reason probably that the people who bought the stock and didn't want to take it up was that they hoped it would be going up in the next account, and they didn't want to pay their money, and by giving them a rate, which it was very small in those days, probably like 5.5%, they would be able to carry it over, and you would, so that they wouldn't have to pay for it, they'd pay on the money. And you had somebody who had sold the stock, didn't want to deliver it, because if they bought it back, in those days you could buy it back closing, they would, and you would give them 4.5% for that, so that you just took a little turn on it. It was a lot of work, I reckon, for very little money, and I don't know who first set the style for doing what then became cash and new, where the bargain was closed on the at the end of the account and bought open again for new time, and the both the broker and the jobber made a good bit more out of it.
When did the contangos disappear?
We certainly didn't do them after the war. So whether it was war casualty or not, I don't know. But it was sort of, it provided a service, I suppose, but frankly, it was more, I reckon, of a nuisance than anything else.
Now, did you feel, as a broker, you were used as a source of intelligence or information on the different markets?
Yes, I think that certainly the job was, did and should have had a fair idea of whether a stock was going up or down, because basically that was their living. In the old days, when names were passing through the offices, it was extremely valuable if a stock had been bought by a broker. You could see his tickets which he passed to you. And in those days, the name of the client and his address were very often on them. And if somebody was buying shares and he was the chairman of the company and he was buying his own shares, the supposition was that you ought to jolly well have those shares. So that it could be quite useful. Two, as I say, you gather that a broker could give you a friendly tip-off. I can remember that a chap came up to me and asked my opinion as to whether he should sell a stock, which I wanted to buy. And I said to him, well, frankly, do you have to sell these? Because I don't think you should. I can't see more. And so he sold them to me. And a couple of days after, they had a jump. And he said, oh, it's the first mistake I've ever made like that. So I said, well, I'm sorry, I did, say I thought you oughtn't sell them because, I might be going away. He said, well, all my life I've acted on the assumption that I would be right if I did exactly the opposite what a jobber said. If he said I oughtn't sell them because they were going up, it meant that he had too much stock on his book and didn't want to buy them, and equally the other way around. So he said, well, that's the first time I've been mistaken. Mm. So obviously the analysts know far more than jobbers, because jobbers were creatures of instinct and feel, and logics didn't apply to them at all. So they could be very much out at times. On the other hand, an analyst says, on this, these shares are cheap, therefore I will buy them. But there may be some reason which an analyst doesn't know, which a jobber may have felt, And he, the jobber will be right and the analyst will be wrong. I'm not decrying them all, they're highly paid people and they do seem to make a market by saying, buy these shares, and then later you read in the paper the same chap saying, oh, I've downgraded my forecast and so on and so forth. But I think probably the answer is that on occasions they were definitely more clued up than the analysts, and they could always give a picture from the shape of the buying, the shape of the selling, the people who were doing it, and they might know a bit about the company, although there was one jobber who came back, as I say, the pitches were very close together in some of them, in the small firms, and he had an extremely good lunch. He sat down, and a chap came up to ask the price of XYZ, and fumbled pound a book, saw XYZ, opened it, made a price, dealt, put it down. When his partner came back, rather than from his dealer came back, said, oh, done anything, sir? Said, oh, yes, I've just got 5,000 XYZ. He said, but we don't deal in them. But what do you mean we don't deal in them? He picked the book, there it is. He said, but that's somebody else's jobbing book. So they had to get the broker back and explain what had happened. You can't really see things like that, I'm afraid, happening now.
No. This might actually lead me into a final area we might talk about, that this particular personalities you think about or recall. Perhaps there might be even partners in your own firm when you started, or people who were characters on the floor of the house back in those early days.
Well, I suppose my own firm, the person who sticks in my mind is Harold Strawn, who's a great cricketer, a delightful character. He'd been wounded in the war, and he's a very good-looking man. Made it even more so that he had a bullet passed, just from missed his eye and passed there. When he went out for an argument, which he did occasionally, he would come back, and if there was a little throb there, I knew I had to be very careful. I think he was wonderful. He was very good to me. He helped me enormously. And I think all the time I was his 2IC, he took me, went for me quite rightly. He bought a line of stock, and I knew, or at least I felt that it was a bad one, and he knew that I felt that way. And he went out to lunch, and he didn't come back for some time, and I had a chance of cutting this bargain. And I thought very carefully. I thought, well, I better do it. I couldn't get hold of him because I didn't know where he'd gone. And so I cut it, and he came back, and of course he saw it. And he really went for me, which was quite right. I shouldn't have done it. I was junior. The fact, I'd say the bit of money was immaterial to that. And I think while I'm on it, there's another character I remember who was the 2IC of a rival jobber. And they were completely different. Harold Straw, and I say he was KOSB and the old King's Scottish Borders and so on, and married a very handsome wife, was in the daughter of one of the whiskey barons and so on and so forth, and they had a large house down Dockshot. And this other chap was completely different. He looked like a Levantine trader, and he was, and he was also a very good jobber. And there was it was before standards, they were going to bring out their small car, and they were running. Market was going up, and we were running a bull tack, and the other chap was running on the bear tack. And they'd both been out to a sort of really stiff lunch. And they didn't like one another, and they were completely, as I say, they were complete opposites. And in those days, there was a challenging system. In other words, you could go to a challenge another jobber, and he could either deal with you or not as he wished. So they started challenging one another, and they were really sort of very comfortably off from the lunch. And they met midway between the two pitches, and I went with my chap, and Hackforth Jones went with his. We couldn't believe it. They were dealing in thousands and absolutely like two stags at bay. So finally, after they'd dealt about half a dozen times, they retired, all very flushed. So Jones and I looked at one another and said, well, of course we can't book these bargains. So we said, oh, we must book something, otherwise, you know, in the morning, there'll be hell. So we halved all the bargains in size as a start, and we looked at one or two which the price looked most peculiar, so we took those out, and eventually we booked about, I think it was about four bargains, which more or less was what they'd intended to do. In other words, our chap had bought them, his chap had sold them. And we got away with it. They, next morning, didn't know anything about it. Neither of them queried it. So you can imagine what that would be happening in this day and age.
Just briefly.
Of the other ones, I suppose, brokers, I remember Kit Hall, who was a tremendous character, those great bushy eyebrows, strike terror in everybody. Very fine chap. The dealers, I suppose, Charles Pennell, everybody of that generation will remember. There's an enormous sort of beetling eyebrows, and as I say, he was Casino's dealer, and so he had used to all the enormous business. He was fair, but pretty tough, and when you had to swallow hard when you were going to take him on. And there was a Colonel Side of De Zoot, who was the first chap I ever did one of these. It almost put throughs off the bargain basement, which they were doing to establish a tax loss. First time I'd ever come across it. I don't know the stock. But it was all the ordinary marks, about 25,000. And he wanted to deal in something like 365,000. And on these deals to establish a tax loss, you had to deal sort of more or less within the price. And he wanted to deal in, I think it was 360,000 shares and put them through for a 16th of a penny, you know, sort of quite a bit below what was obviously the normal market price. So I thought, bluntly, can I do this? So he said, all right, well, what are you going to bid me for 360,000? So I saw his point. That was being the price that one would probably have made in three. So he said, okay. He said, don't worry about it. We've taken legal advice on this, and this is all right. But if you would bid more, then you've got to tell me. So I said, no, well, I wouldn't have bid more. So we did the 360,000 at the 16. It was the first time I'd come across it in those days. He was a pretty good man. The other chap I remember was Geoffrey Perkins of Greaves and Grant, who we used to do a lot of business with him. And he was a very, very shrewd cookie and went pretty well as near the knuckle as he could do, and I had to, when he retired, I had to make his farewell speech to him, make his presentation and so on, as a mixture of brokers and jobbers. And I remember saying that he was admirable for all young dealers to meet him early on in life, because they would gain greatly by experience. Dealing with him was a sort of triumph of hope over experience. So he, as he was retired, he took it in good part, but he, I suppose this is not really for the tape, but I found out always when one had to be especially careful, you'd see his rubbing his finger and thumb. Unfortunately, after a couple of years, somebody told him about it, which is a great pity. But when I said he was used to go near the knuckle. I don't necessarily think it was him only, but he would ask for price and size in large amounts of stock. And the first two or three times I made it, and he'd say, well, can I take that out? You'd say yes. And then towards the end of the day, if he came back in the late in the afternoon, he'd say, is there any change? Now, if there had been a change, he would have said so, and that would have been that. And if you said no, that's
change
in the price, or the size you'd made it in. Yes. So if there wasn't, you said no, we'd deal with you in this chunk. So I think, right, okay, now I know so-and-so's interest. We were talking about making business, so I thought, well, I think this is would attract these two brokers. So you go and offer it to them, and they would go and offer it on. Obviously below the market price, because you bought it below the market price and you had to make it attractive. And one day both of them came back and said, oh, well, our client's seen this, which had meant that he already knew that the stock had been offered and turned it down. So they had got the job as price so that they could go to the client and say, right, we can sell it at, say, 45 bob. And because the market price you made, should we say, 46 bob to sixpence, and you'd made them 45 to 47 bob in this chunk. But we think we can get you more. They would then go around and try and place it so that they would get the two commissions. No luck, they'd come back and stuff you 45 bob. So that, as I say, nothing wrong, you did it. Your fault as a jobber for doing it. So after that, you became fairly cagey. And after about a quarter of an hour, you'd never even say, well, you're still taking my price because, say, well, I'm going to have to cancel it if you don't deal in the next couple of minutes. And they said, again, quite justifiably, that they would have been, I had this out in a sort of fairly friendly way after him, because we did part from these very ordinary things, get on quite well. And he said, no, you see, what we do is, okay, we tell the client we'll get that, and because we've made the point, well, supposing your client, we're told that the buyer's no longer interested, your client won't get 45 shillings, so you're not doing your best for him. Mm. And he said, oh no, if that happened, we as a firm would take the stock. Mm. So client wouldn't lose anything.
Yes.
Just
in conclusion, a couple of things you mentioned you might just explain. Mm. You said you were a 2IC to your...
Yes, I was a dealer and he was the partner.
So that's what 2IC
yes.
means.
Yes, I'm sorry, I was using a sort of army slang.
Jargon.
I was his dealer.
I see.
Sorry.
And now you said you had a first experience of a bargain basement. Someone was trying to establish a tax loss in a share. Can you explain that a bit more?
Yes.
Who was trying to establish the tax loss?
The client. And he had a great holding of this.
I see.
And he wanted to do it in one piece. Mm. And in those days, you had to, if you were doing this, to comply with the Inland Revenue, you had to take that stock and hold it, whether you wanted it or not. And then, the next day, the broker come back and take it, or if he didn't want to, he didn't have to. And that was to comply. So you would only do such a deal, in a stock that was reasonable. I mean, if it's a dud stock, you'd say, sorry, no go. And with somebody that you trusted, who said, well, this is what it is, and you'd expect it. But equally, the jobber could have said, no, I bought these, and you can whistle for them to get them back.
I see.
You're going to keep it. So yes. That was the first time I'd met it, I remember.
Yes. Well, let's conclude.
Market officials?
The market officials. You want to mention that?
I think this was a typical thing of the sort of sensible system of the poachers turned gamekeepers. They were people who were still on the stock exchange and who'd had a considerable dealing experience, so that they were either senior dealing partners of jobbers or senior brokers. And the whole idea was that when a query happened, usually, as I say, between a broker and jobber, two sides would come to you. You could hear them one by one to start with, so that the broker said his side, and then you'd think that over and note that, and you'd get the jobber in and hear his side, and then you would make a ruling as to who was right or wrong or what should be done. We were working under the stock exchange committees, and we always made it quite clear that we had no jurisdiction. We couldn't lay this down. We could say, this is what you should do. But if you don't agree with it, you can reject our ruling and go up to the committee. And I think virtually only one that I can remember in the time went out that they didn't take it. And because we knew the rules backwards from both sides, and we often found out that they were a mistake. Somebody had said the thing wrong casually, then taken it up, then felt they had to justify it. Then it had gone up to the head partners. In the old days, you would then have the sort of, two tops of the firm hemming around. If it could be settled amicably between the two dealers at the time, who might or might not be partners, well, they didn't have to be partners. Sometimes it was a dealer who came in with his dealing partner. And also, then they would accept that. And also, it did mean that I suppose also you could say that they learned something from their mistakes. And it didn't involve the firms.
Yes.
So it was a pretty good thing. It went on right till the end. Even, I think, after the Big Bang, they still had them. And they were usually it was two brokers and a jobber.
How did one become a market official?
You were asked you had to be assumed or to know your stuff, and B, to be willing to do it. And then whoever's charged the committee at that time would ask if you'd do it, and you'd say yes, fine. You had eventually a little box of your own, and then we've established case history. It's very interesting, actually. And I felt it was a sort of good way of ending one's career, because so many of these times that the actual argument was very minor, but people had got entrenched so early, and then once they got entrenched, and then their own people had to back them, and the thing, would get out of all proportion. And also then if large put-throughs were being done off the market basis, there were certain rules on how that should be carried out, so we would advise on that and tell them what they could do or what they couldn't, and whether they would have to mark a bargain or whether there were extenuating circumstances in the book of rules where the bargain need not be marked, which we knew, and which we then made sure that they understood it. There was no further business at that price, it was the end of the autumn, so on and so forth. So that was very interesting. I met some very interesting people also in that little box. I remember Sir Nigel Mordaunt was there, and James Capel's people.
Now, what period were you a market official? Was this during the last
This was just before I retired. It was sort of seeing me out, because
yes.
I wasn't running a book, and I was only about 10 yards away from my pitch on there, where Biscoe Bishop were.
Well, looking at the jobbing system from post-Big Bang now, looking back to your career, what would you say were the main strengths of the jobbing system?
In the old days?
In the old days.
I think it was certainly the strength of the people in it that goes through all the firms, really, that we were certainly providing the service which was needed at that time. As I said earlier, you know, the smaller clients began to fall by the wayside. That meant smaller brokers were, and the stock exchange was then evolving into bigger units. And because it wasn't done with a wild rush like the Big Bang, the mergers took place, and the system, I think, worked well. And thinking of some of the flaps that happened in the time, how quickly the jobbing system got a price gain again, which would have taken, I mean, you know, New York would have had to have the pause and so on and so forth, but probably within 30 seconds there was a price. I mean, it might be a wide price, it might have been a large enough market amount to start with, but there was a price on which the business could start again very, very quickly, 30 seconds perhaps. So that I think we used to take, jobbers used to take quite a lot of stick because they wouldn't take stock in a really flat market. Well, one worked out if the amount of shares that you dealt in, if you bought, I think it was something like, we worked out if you bought 200 shares in every stock you dealt in, the market price, apart from the fact that it was going down, so you lose a lot of money on that, it'd use up sort of about 10 times one's capital. So obviously, if the market was going to drop, you know, as I say earlier on in life, when Hitler had marched into Dayton Land or whatever it was, or socialist government had come in, or taxes had violently, you moved the price to find where the market was. And one had a good relationship. I'm thinking particularly of the Greaves and Grant. You didn't have to deal with your opposition market makers. Therefore, unless he was a buyer, if he was a seller, he was no good coming to another jobber, because if he was a buyer, he might come over and close part of his position. But so we held the prices fairly gently, didn't knock them completely wildly. And then the institutions would come in through their broker, and I'm thinking particularly Greaves and Grant, and they would put a limit below the price of a reasonable amount. And so immediately you had a buyer. So you could sell a bit of it or decide, right, well, this is the area, and you got a business gain straight away. And nowadays they get knocked down so fast that with the best will in the world, the institutions, you know, just sort of watch it until the thing stops. Then they try and get in again, and of course, it goes back again. So I think that in some ways that system served its purpose, but I agree now that it's got so international and so large that this new system is the one that's worked, but people haven't made money out of it, really, which I think is a pity. And they have at least stopped when the thing first started, the market makers had to deal with one another on the price on the screen. And that now, I think, has been cancelled. They don't have to. So you can imagine, you know, the sort of the price on the screen was going down like that. Look at an even worse bloodbath. We used to mark them up in red on the board. Not quite so bad.
Good. Well, I think we'll...
Yes, I'll run you to the station. There would be the various components. One of my uncles was on the board of Lucas. I think it was really in those days, when the lorries, of course, it was more or less on that basis.
Yes.
And then it spread out. We spread then into... later on, we bought a small firm, took it over the shipping, but then we were also doing industrials, which stuff like ICI and the big ones, which we'd had a little firm, which was we took the chap in, a fellow called Williams, because he was very nice, and we probably come on to this.
Yes.
When we're talking about the enormous amount of jobbers that there used to be and how they shrunk. Yes. So we then started dealing with some of those.
Yes.
And then we expanded considerably more over the years. But that was the core business in those days.
Mm. Can we talk a little bit about what you did as a dealer, say, during the late 30s? Could you describe a typical day? For example,
yes.
You say you were attached to a particular partner, you work for a particular partner. What did that involve?
Well, I think you had one of the attractions of jobbing, of course, was the fact that you could make a terrible mess of it on Tuesday and come back to the fight on Wednesday and start again. And so you would have, going to work, an idea of your positions, what you wanted to do, what you ought to do, how you would adjust the price. You'd also be reading your papers. Oh, hell.